Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the productive middle and have on the productive right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you and productive as always.
Yeah, great to have the state auditor in this studio and Shireen Gourbani on the productive left.
Oh, hello and hi, listeners. Grateful you're tuning in.
So productive, why am I emphasizing that? We're going to talk about the legislative session today. That's a word to describe the session. It was very productive this year.
500
plus. And it's over. And it's over.
We're gonna do a deep dive here, but let's set it up, John and Shireen, a little bit by just talking about how this all comes to be. I hope that's okay to be just reflective for a minute. To me, one of the ways of being reflective is it's 104 individuals.
Sit on back, boys and girls. We're gonna go through this.
Yeah, 104 individuals. One person, one vote, and you get 104 individuals, 75 House members, 29 Senate. They all come from different walks of life, different occupations, different
regions, philosophies. Regions of the state.
Geography. And we put them in this pressure cooker for 45 days and have them go do, and to your point, Shireen, 500 plus bills.
Yeah. Many more filed.
Well, that's what passed.
Yeah, many more filed.
Yeah. And John, you've been a legislator. Give us some color commentary, because what I want to impress upon the listeners is it's pretty hard to characterize this group.
Yeah, I mean, you've got
Shireen rolled her eyes almost.
You've got folks all over the spectrum in terms of different issues and how they see the world on certain things, and what it means to be conservative or liberal depends on what the issue is and the circumstances and all those kind of dynamics. And like you said, it's fast and furious. There are so many issues on so many topics that lots of them you're not an expert on. You're an expert on a few areas, but you're not an expert on everything. And you look at the magnitude of what's coming in and your constituents reaching out to you and lobbyists reaching out to you and your colleagues in the legislature, whether it's House or Senate, governor's office, whatever it might be, reaching out, trying to give their input. And you're trying to distill that down and you're trying to make a decision. And I used to tell folks, the decisions between good and bad, those were really easy. And decisions between good and better, those weren't too hard. It was when the decision was between bad and worse, and you weren't sure what was bad and what was worse, those were the hardest decisions because you had to vote on it. You couldn't just say, no thanks, I'm not voting. You had to vote yes or no on those difficult issues.
Shireen, your color commentary, because John and I are both coming from this as complex, and be careful how you judge it, but let's hear you.
So I do think that's correct. What you mentioned, the diversity, when we think about region, professions. Actually, professions is one where we don't have quite as much diversity as we could.
We've a lot of home builders, a lot of realtors.
A lot of home builders, a lot of realtors. We have a significant, obviously, we have a supermajority Republican body. We also have a significantly male-dominated body. Now, there have been more women elected in the Republican Party lately, which is nice to see a little bit more balance there. But we have a vast over-representation of men in that body. And then we also have, in some ways, some younger people coming into the ranks, some of the youngest this year. But really, it's a much older body too, and it's a much more LDS body than the state is as a whole. So those are some of the dynamics, I think, in terms of congruity that are at play. Yeah. But there's also, I think right now, a moment of great change. There is, people don't stay there forever, typically. Some do.
Average tenure for a House member is about 6 years.
About 6 years. But this, especially with redistricting, there are a number of new people in the body right now. And so I think that this is maybe a learning year, kind of seeing how things are going to be. I would say that this year was a year that we saw more happening around sort of the, I would just say deep entrenchment of kind of culture war things that are happening on the right and frankly on the far right that I wouldn't say are maybe the mainstream interest of most or maybe the more powerful Republicans on the Hill.
Yeah.
But we are definitely seeing those trends show up here in Utah, and that's disappointing.
Yeah. I'll make one comment, then I have a question for you. I would say that some of the culture war things that were going on, I mean, they get a lot of play, but when I made my list of things that were on my mind to talk about in a deep dive on the session, I had all these consequential things. To me, that's the word. It was a consequential session. They dealt with education and water and housing and homelessness and tax cuts. And there was a fair amount of some of the social things, but boy, did they do a lot.
They did a lot. And I know we've talked quite a bit about some of the education bills, but I've been hearing from teachers and just have a sense, if you're, follow UT poll, I suggest also checking out UT Ed hashtag on Twitter and seeing what teachers were experiencing over this last session. I do think many people felt in that profession deeply maligned, attacked, undervalued, not treated as professionals. There was a lot of damage done to our education community, but there were also historic investments. So it's a tough year.
We'll go through each of these, like education things, whatever. John, can you just...
I thought we were going to just stick with the culture stuff.
If there was something that stood out for you, you know, so Senator Dan McKay made a huge contribution on both sides of the aisle, you know, has been a co-host. I hope to have him again soon. But wow,
what are you saying?
Well, did he have his fingers on a lot of things, right?
Yeah, he was intimately involved.
Tax cut, abortion, flags, I mean, all sorts of things. But that's something that stood out for me is what Senator Dan, is there something that stood out for you?
I think one of the key things that I've mentioned before that stood out was just how they jumped out on certain big issues right out of the chute.
Yeah, the pace and the speed. Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, oftentimes some of those difficult issues are left towards the end, just partly because of the complexity. And I tell folks, you know, when they ask, why does the legislature leave big things to the end? It's because they can't leave it any later.
That's pretty good. Shireen, something that stood out for you, other than just the culture war thing, was there sort of like a little, you know, jewel or gem or disappointment or something that our listeners would find interesting?
Yeah, well, I have a number of jewels, honestly. There were many things that I was really excited to see. One, postpartum Medicaid expansion, meaning that there is an opportunity to extend more coverage for a longer period of time to new parents, new moms.
What a fabulous thing.
A fabulous thing, especially when we think about the challenges that people can have in those first years. And in particular, our rates of postpartum depression, like those issues are much more easily addressed when people have ongoing care. That's a wonderful thing that I'm glad that we saw move forward. I will say that there's kind of a pattern often of things that Democrats have been championing for a long time that ultimately get a Republican to move it through and then it gets done, that being one of them. But then we also have, you know, investments, some additional really good investments in education. But for me, the biggest one that I could, like, honestly burst into tears over, I'm very excited, was an effort that Senator Escamilla has been working on for a number of years to extend early coverage for kids for non-U.S. citizens. So we are now moving forward in this state with coverage for undocumented kids, kids who are here because their parents came here, to get them access to basically a CHIP program.
Wow.
This is...
Somehow I didn't notice that one.
Yep. So this is huge. And as, you know, I've talked about before, as a kid who grew up, not because of my status, uninsured, but knowing what that can do to families and even just, you know, one kid in that group with cancer or one kid in that group with autism, like the change that this can make in these families' lives is monumental. And to see so many people come together across the... Like, this was a bipartisan effort to get this done.
Yeah.
Jim Dunnigan was the House sponsor, and Senator Escamilla has been working on it for a number of years. This is, to me, a reflection of when we talk about Utah values. I think that's often empty. But for me, I know that there are
pieces of it that are important.
Great.
John, on the tax cut side, I read some coverage about the tax cut. They called it historic yet measured. And I thought that was a great characterization of it because I think they could have done more. That's what I'm meaning by the measured. But because of uncertainty and stuff, they were careful. But you know, they lowered the income tax rate. They expanded the Social Security tax credit. They helped with, low-income housing credits. They gave us the thing to get the sales tax off food if we get rid of the earmark. I mean, these are consequential. These are historic. These are measured. Your thoughts?
So one of the key things, I know there was some discussion about whether there was going to be tax reform or not. This was really just tax cuts, some broad-based, which is what I'm a fan of, and some that were more targeted, as you mentioned. I always come from the perspective of how do we get money back in the pockets of everyday Utahns? And so something like that,
so
I think, is a good thing.
Nearly $800 million back into the pockets, right?
Or going back into the pockets.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, yeah. The earned income tax credit went from 15% to 20% of the federal. Those are all big things. Do you want to say anything more on tax
cuts? Well, I'm actually curious when you think about, I feel like at the end, the conversation was that potentially our economic outlook isn't quite as robust as maybe people thought. What's your response to that, or what caution did you give anyone?
Glad you asked, because if I would have thought to do this, I would have framed it this way. I think this was a consequential session because we had means to do important things. And that comes back to the economy. This economy, the history books will write about COVID and the Utah economy and will say that we prevailed. We had, you know, the second highest job growth during the pandemic, and we had the fourth lowest cumulative case fatality rate from COVID. And So as when you write the history of this, our legislature got to go in and do so much for housing, homelessness, water conservation, education, transportation, infrastructure, because our economy enabled that. So then looking forward, I think they were wise to not cut too deep because, you know, we've got challenges.
Can I ask you a question?
The Fed today making it, you know, even worse, right? We got the Jerome Powell essentially saying, hey, I think we're going to have to do even be more aggressive.
If you look at how much the budget has increased over the last year or two, would you say they're just as measured in spending, or what are your thoughts there?
You know, John, this is a great question because people like to measure spending and get all enamored by it, concerned by it. But I'm one of these that believes that growth costs, that more people and more congestion and more
urbanization.
It's expensive. It's what we want to do. It's a choice, but it's expensive. And so I don't think of expenditures rising so much as the mean beast of government growing as I do servicing the needs of a population. Now, I know you feel a little differently than I do there.
Yeah,
but
one of those things is the question of what is that rate of growth and stuff like that. And that's where you get into the concern, which is, okay, there's tax cuts there, but constrained, or are we really booming when it comes to spending?
I would go
as well
to where are there inefficiencies, you know, and I'd go after inefficiencies, but I wouldn't just right off the bat call growth and expenditures the problem. I would look for unwise expenditures as the problem.
Yeah, and I partly asked that question because we thought we had a boom time in, as I recall, 2008, uh-huh. Then middle of the year, housing market fell apart, and we were in there quickly cutting budgets.
The oxygen left the room.
Absolutely, and it left overnight.
Yeah, it did. Well, let's talk more about it. We'll go into some specific areas in the second session. I'm Natalie Gochner with John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and we're talking about the 2023 general legislative session. We want to start by talking about education. There's a conundrum here. That's a word you hear, you know, up on Capitol Hill, but education got a nearly 20% increase in funding. I think it was 18 plus or something.
Which, massive.
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 Massive. I think they got $578 million of new ongoing and then several hundred thousand of one time. I mean, it was a massive session for education. And at the same time, the conundrum is that the education profession and most of the education interest groups opposed a lot of this most impactful legislation that occurred.
So why is that?
School choice scholarships, asking voters on the earmark. Those are the things they didn't like. Shireen, let's go to you first in the sense that, the way I kind of wrestle with this is I guess I could say I'm a three-decade Capitol Hill veteran. And I've never seen the education community and the legislature truly aligned.
Yeah.
They've always been at odds. I worked at the state capitol when the teachers went on strike last time. I saw them come up and rally up there. It sounded like the building was going to break down with noise because they were, you know, chanting.
Yeah.
And it echoes and reverberates.
And it kind of backfired on them as a result.
It did. Yeah. But my point is that I've always felt it was a conundrum. And it's always thrown me off because we're a family-oriented state, a state with the highest percentage of children, a state that values education, a state that gets good education outcomes.
Yeah. So what I heard from teachers is that they felt incredibly disrespected. Mm-hmm. I think
How so?
Well, the range of conversations about books or even the, you know, kind of temporary bubbling up of the Don't Say Gay here, right?
Yeah. Like publishing your curriculum in advance.
Publishing your curriculum in advance. Feeling like this is a legislature that does not, what I heard from individuals was that they felt like they were not trusted. They are not respected as professionals. They are people who are navigating really difficult and complex challenges across our society. Ask teachers about, you know, issues from hunger to violence to and I mean like domestic, like what people experience in their homes, to, you know, healthcare. All of these issues come into your classroom. And what I have experienced is that the teachers that we have here give their hearts and souls to this job and felt like they were, because of political wins, put into a blender, really, like a grinder from this legislature in some ways, with this kind of persistent, just coming at it from different angles around trying to devalue and disrespect their profession. And I certainly understand that we see these, you know, videos pop up here and there that, you know, get people riled up about what's happening in classrooms. But in the vast majority of cases, teachers are giving it their all every day, and they care deeply about our communities.
So let me ask a question, because Natalie talked about three decades on the Hill. She started when she was in elementary school, clearly. But
I got some gray hairs to show for it.
You've talked about the this feeling of disrespect. Is that something you think has been heightened over the last couple of years coming out of COVID or through COVID? Or is this just a continuation of the last several decades?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a COVID effect.
Yeah.
It seems like the fact that they went to homeschooling and kept kids out of school really bothered conservatives.
Right. Well, but, and more parents kind of saw some of the dynamics that were taking place and got agitated about some of that. But
John, I have a theory here that to me, I mentioned that there's always been a conundrum, but I think this is an issue, I could be totally wrong, that breaks down a little bit along gender lines. I think that women and mothers approach education differently than men and fathers. I could be wrong. I'm not going from...
How so?
Well, so this is how I do describe it.
Said the man and father.
My children went to Parkside Elementary School in the Murray School District. It's a Title I school. It's a great community school. Miss Thomas bought violins for everyone in her fourth grade class and taught her kids how to play the violin. Miss Larson had Ertl the turtle and had a turtle that would, you know, have eggs and the kids could take the eggs home. And I mean, Ms. Cosgrove, the kindergarten teacher, would make stone soup with the kids. I mean, I had an overwhelmingly positive experience for my children in this public school system. And I want to do anything I can to lighten their load. I'm just not sure.
And I had a very mixed experience. I mean, I had teachers that I thought were doing an incredible job in public ed, and I had teachers that I wondered why they were even in the system. And you know, so I saw kind of a spectrum. And so maybe that's me kind of coming with this expectation.
My guess is that you're pretty actively involved in your kids' education, but I'm not so sure if all men are. This is where I'm getting the gender lines, because I get the feeling that a lot of women see it in a way that sometimes men don't. When you go to parent-teacher conferences, there's a lot of women meeting with teachers.
Teachers.
Now, I probably just violated all these research principles, meaning because I'm just going from anecdotal experience there. But you were
so politically insensitive.
Well, but I share that experience because I can't figure out. It seems to me like you should be able to work with the Superintendents Association and with the Teachers Association and with,
Well, let me share kind of, and it doesn't deal with teachers, but it's an interesting dynamic of what you're highlighting. Years ago, I was working on something. We were trying to cut line items and give greater flexibility for spending. Mm-hmm. And I had superintendents telling me, no, we don't want you to do that. So they'd complain on the one side that they wanted more freedom and flexibility.
Yeah.
But then they didn't want us to get rid of the earmarks in the funding because they wanted to use that in their battle with the teachers union. And so it was one of these things.
That's hard.
Do you want to grow up and have freedom and flexibility and responsibility? Yeah. Or do you really want us to micromanage?
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a legislator, you're kind of getting whipsawed by this message of give us more freedom. But don't give us more freedom.
Don't you think as a principal that it would probably be better if there was less education bills every session? Just the principle that every bill is some sort of meddling.
Well, in the past we used to talk about, 70 or 75 education bills a year. I think there were upwards of about 150 this year. And so, from my perspective, that is excessive. But one of the key things is, on the one side, we're talking about more educational choice and freedom and, if you will, empowering parents to decide the educational opportunities for their child, their student. Mm-hmm. And yet on the flip side, it's like more and more and more regulation on the traditional system. And it's like...
And almost none on the other system.
And so it's, and this is where I come from, which is, okay, I'm all for let's empower parents to provide more of the oversight and get, policymakers out of that. But let's be consistent on both sides of the fence.
Yeah. You know how we've heard of that we need it, that some people are saying that this country's headed towards a national divorce, but what we really need is marriage counseling. I think that the legislature and education needs some marriage counseling.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to question the motives of legislators, but I do want to question, and then I don't want to question why educators feel mistreated, but I do see a gap. And I think it's our children suffer because of the gap.
Well, but you've got the dynamic of citizens, parents. And one of the dynamics I hear too often historically has been school doesn't care. Mm-hmm. They don't care. They're not talking about a specific teacher. They like their teacher, but the system as a whole doesn't listen to them. It grinds them up. It says, no, this is our rule. We don't care.
Yeah.
And it's like you're sitting there as a parent going, the needs of my child are not being addressed. They are falling behind and they're flailing and they're desperate to try and help their child in a bureaucratic system that too often was just not listening to them. And so we're getting all that kind of mixed together.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder if it's a Utah County problem, Shereen.
Oh, what an interesting thought.
All I mean is lots of kids, crowded schools, lots of growth, and somehow you feel mistreated. Because in my experience in the school system, I felt the love and care of the administrators and of the teachers. If I had a problem, I mean, you don't always win the lottery and get the best teacher, but you go talk about it and you get your student moved. And they accommodate, they listen to parents. Okay. Hey, let's talk about water.
Okay.
I think, just for context, they spent over $500 million last year in water, and I think they spent over $420 million this year. Water for agriculture, water optimization, for water reuse, for aqueducts, other water infrastructure. They got a great Salt Lake commissioner, turf buyback programs.
Goodness. Do you think that what you saw met the moment that we're in with the lake?
I absolutely do.
You do?
Shereen,
so good to be with optimists.
Well, the reason is...
Maybe you don't think it's enough, or...
I'm worried about it. I continue to be worried about it.
It is just an unbelievably wet year. I'm a skier. I'm tracking this a lot. My son is a weather, you know, phenom, and he keeps me posted. And they didn't have to do all the emergency things because God blessed us this year. And they've got some other things in their pocket they can do later. But in terms of the long-term investments, to put $200 million into agricultural water optimization that's going to make Cache Valley more water efficient, that will help the lake.
That will help. I just want to reiterate, though, and you said here, that you know how much snow we get, how much precipitation we get, is not really necessarily the driving factor of the health of our lake long-term.
It was a blessing this year.
It was a blessing this year. It is not going to return the lake to the levels that it needs to be or that range that we think is healthy.
But ag water optimization will.
That is.
Water reuse will.
Yes.
Water. Now, the big debate, Shereen, and John, you should weigh in here, will be between how much water do you keep in the reservoirs and how much do you let get to the lake?
Into the lake.
I'd love to hear you comment on that, John, because that's going to be the water battle, because they're going to have a lot of water, but the reservoirs need water, too.
Yeah. And I think this year, one of the key concerns is going to be flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be wrestling with...
See if God smiles on us
here.
Is
too much coming into the reservoirs versus what do we got to release?
Yeah.
And I've been downstream sometimes when they've released, and, you know, it's gotten close to flooding. You know, in my neighborhood, not quite there, but you know.
Yeah, well, I think they roast the Cajun on water.
Did they do pricing? Did they fix the pricing issue?
They did 15 million more for secondary water metering, which will help with that ultimately down the road. But no, they didn't fix it.
And so to me, that's where it's lackluster.
Yeah.
The key fundamental thing of pricing water to what it really costs to provide.
Yeah. And
that's
what
we got to do rather than subsidize this and subsidize that.
They did not set a great Salt Lake target level, which I think over time will be a wise thing to do. Housing homelessness, really quickly, another place where they did a lot of good.
Yeah. So, again, always a place where when we're thinking about long-term investments in affordable housing, that is like the jam. That's good, right?
Yeah.
So big investments there.
$200 million.
Yep, certainly could see more, and I hope we will continue to see more. I think one of the things that's really positive here, I serve on the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness, where a number of the providers are, you know, together running a number of different committees where we're focused on everything from crisis response to employment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like all these different groups coming together. In my experience there and when I was on the county council, I would say there was sometimes a really adversarial relationship between those entities and then what was happening at the state. I feel like we're moving towards a place of greater alignment,
mm-hmm.
and seeing really, I think, thoughtful conversations, trying to get the right investments, having really important leadership from Wayne Niederhauser and others that are continuing to try to educate and shepherd through responses to a really complex problem. I think there was good stuff here. Could be better, but it was good.
Yeah. John, your comment on housing homelessness? Got about
a
minute.
I think one of the dynamics I hear from a lot of Utahns is we throw more and more and more money. It doesn't seem to be getting better. In fact, it seems to often be getting worse. And when they come to the quote-unquote the big city here in Salt Lake and they see all sorts of people on the streets and they're going, I thought we solved this a few years ago. And
yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say it's a moving target. It'd be worse if we hadn't been doing all that we're doing.
And growth, you also mentioned, when we have population growth, and that means all of our populations grow, and it's just
They did pass a bill that mandated county homeless shelters and enforcing anti-camping things. Mm-hmm. And then some of the things they did didn't cost money. They passed a bill that blocked referendums that would override, county council decisions, planning commission decisions. I think regulation reforms are really important. Mm-hmm. Quickly, in a word, how would you describe it, John, the session? One
the session? Done.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Over. I don't know. Grateful it's done. I just need a break.
I'm going to go with consequential. I think they did a ton.
And part of the dynamic from my perspective is you can't see how consequential it is in the moment. You got to look back a decade and see how consequential it is.
Oh, but we can't close this out without saying new flag.
New flag. That's your word. I got to love it.
Wave it.
Wave it.
Celebrate it.
Wave it proudly.
Ceremonial flag and party flag.
Natalie Gochner, John Dougal, Shereen Gorbani. Thanks for listening, everybody. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thank you for listening.